Okay, so what's your name?
My name is Shayna Agad.
And what's the group that you work for?
It's called Critical Resistance.
And so what does Critical Resistance do?
We're a community-based organization. We exist nationally, but we organize in small, local, relatively autonomous groups, and we do community organizing against prisons and policing. So our primary focus is focusing on abolition of what we call the prison industrial complex. So that includes everything from prisons themselves to the kind of systems that make them possible. So policing and surveillance and the kind of way that those things get used to control people. We imagine that in order for abolition to be a realistic goal, we have to create things that will make it possible for people to, A, not get locked up in the first place, and B, you know, come home, be safe, stay home, and be able to participate and have self-determination in their own communities. So the idea is not that people would stay sort of under state supervision, but really the communities would be able to have the resources to allow people to come home and deal with each other in a respectful way, but really be able to do what they want to do in their lives.
You had mentioned the term prison abolitionist.
Abolitionist.
Now, people are going to react and say, oh my God, what are you talking about?
Right.
That sounds so difficult. When you say that, what would be some of the kind of policies in replace of a kind of prison system that we have today?
Well, a lot of that, I think, is based in this idea that people could be self-sufficient in their communities, right? So what we imagine is that in order to make it possible to get rid of prisons and to get rid of, you know, state police forces and city police forces, that small community-based structures need to be in place. So, like, there need to be schools where everybody can get, I mean, a lot of this sounds kind of commonplace, but there need to be schools where everybody can get education, not just young people, but adults also, where there's interaction between young people and adults. People need the kinds of resources that are going to be able to keep them safe and healthy. So people need mental health care and people need physical health care, right? They need that to be easily accessible, so it's not a struggle to be able to stay healthy or to be able to get off drugs if you want to get off drugs, or to be able to, you know, deal with your depression if you're depressed. And then kind of to address the question that of course always comes up, which is, what do you do if people hurt each other? What we imagine is that two things. In society where people are less deprived and less poor and not fighting for their lives in the same way, people are going to be less likely to hurt each other. And then beyond that, obviously people are still going to cross those boundaries. And we have to develop ways that essentially create a safe environment, both for the person who crosses the boundaries, if anybody gets hurt, for the person who gets hurt, and for the whole community to deal with those things in a real way. So that might take the shape of something like, you know, community forums or community sort of meetings, or like a council of like elders and young people who can help people develop problems. And some of those things are definitely already being experimented with, both in this country and internationally. You know, just for example, the Zapatistas down in Chiapas have what's called the kitchen jail. If people break the social rules of the community, they end up getting placed in sort of a limited kind of confinement, but it's in the middle of the community. So people come by, they talk to them, you know, so there's just different models. And a lot of what we're talking about is that removing people from communities doesn't leave communities whole and doesn't leave people whole. And obviously it hasn't done anything to make people any safer. So that really in the long run, we have to look at ways that are sustainable so that people, you can't just exile people and expect things to get better.
And you had mentioned before this idea that suggesting that communities bear responsibility, like it's not just the individual, but there's actually the community does have. Can you explain that, this notion of accountability?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of times, especially in prison and treatment, people get just like hammered over the head with like, prison's good for you because it makes you accountable and you need to, you know, take accountability for your crime and you need to do this and you need to do that and you need to realize that you've done wrong, okay? So people go through this whole process. They come out of prison thinking that prison's the best thing that ever happened to them, when in reality, lots of other things also could have helped out and helped somebody be able to be in a position to make different choices if that's the case. I would also argue that a lot of times the way our society is set up, it's not just about people's individual choices. So like people do crime for reasons that are really not a ton about individual choice. They're about economic disparity and they're about racism and they're about all kinds of things that aren't about personal choice. So that in that way, I think communities, in two ways, the whole like giant social community has an accountability to its members to make sure that people can live, you know? And then in addition to that, individual sort of smaller communities, I think it would be great if people could, in those communities, take on accountability to bring people home and make that safe and make that possible. And people need resources to do that. It's not like, oh yeah, people are just sitting back being lazy and they won't bring people home. I think tons of people are working to do that. But it's really, really difficult without resources.
If you were to name some of the reasons why you think there is this increase in the prison industry in the United States, what comes to mind? Is it like an easy solution, convenient solution? Is it the, yeah, what would you say?
I mean, I think there are a few things that have, I mean, historically there's, right, that you can talk about the whole gamut of the war on drugs. You can talk about the fact that prisons have been used to crush social dissent and to crush political dissent. And really the huge increase, you know, the 500 or whatever percent increase since the late 70s, I think is attributable to several things. And I think the war on drugs is one of them. I think that finding sort of places to warehouse people who were in the 60s and 70s rising up and trying to change the system and undo white supremacy. I think that those are both huge reasons that the prison system has grown the way it has. I think economic incentives are another reason the prison system has grown. And I think ultimately we've gotten to a point where prisons are social policy. You know, so the answer to everything is build a prison and lock some people up. So everything is becoming a crime. You know, so it's kids are getting locked up because they don't show up to class. You know, I mean, it's just absolutely everything is becoming criminalized because it's the idea is the more people you remove, the better whatever's left is going to be. You know, I mean, it's not true, but I think that that's been the policy.
At a national level, critical resistance, is there a kind of lobbying effort? And if so, what are the kind of policies? Are you pushing for changing the drug war kind of policies or working for economic development in poor areas? Is there a particular policy focus that you guys are working on?
We actually don't focus on policy much at all. We focus almost entirely on grassroots organizing. And so in some places that has taken the shape of some legislative work. Like out in California, they have a campaign where they're trying to stop this 5,000-bed prison from being built. And a piece of that campaigning, part of it has been community organizing in the communities most affected by this prison, so where it would go and where people would be coming from. And part of it has also been some state lobbying. But I think ultimately we believe that the power's got to come up from the bottom, so to speak, and that power exists there already. It's just a matter of recognizing it there as opposed to saying, you know, oh, there are targets up in government and we need to get them to agree with us. We're not as interested in going that route and more interested in kind of pushing it up from the bottom.
You had mentioned some efforts that have been taken in New York City. On a community level, could you describe some of the kind of groups that have been set up to help facilitate prisoners? What do they do and how does that work?
Well, there are a fair number of resources available in New York City. Unfortunately, like almost all resources, if they're good, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then they start getting state funding, and then they start essentially turning into, you know, things that are much more dependent on whatever the state tells them to be. And so I think that there are several reintegration-oriented places that do great work. I tutor at a place called the Fortune Society that does a lot of reintegration work. But one of the holes that we see is that people come out, and even if they've got sort of one set of services to go to, there's still this whole other slew of things, that the needs that can't get met. And just facing those challenges can totally undo you, you know, and not because, you know, you're weak because you came out of jail, but like, it's a lot of pressure to go through all those systems and deal with all that bureaucracy. And plus having this pressure of, you know, a probation officer, a parole officer, people were talking about FSU, people watching over you, you know, so there's this total element of control. Everybody's sort of watching for you to screw up. And so one of the things that we've been talking about is really taking our activist perspective and trying to figure out what people need, you know, so before they can become activists and, you know, be trying to deal with this sort of larger system in a theoretical way, we really need to be thinking about, like, what's practical and what people need in order to really address the changes we're talking about making. And I think it's just this coalescing of the fact that people have needs for social services and people have needs to get through those things, retaining their dignity, you know, and retaining their humanity. And that the people who've been through those systems over and over again are going to be the best people to set up those networks for others, you know. And so part of our work is making sure those resources are there and helping to coordinate some of that. And we're just at the very beginning stages of trying to set up a series of maybe a year-long series of workshops and discussions at a residential treatment facility for women and their children in New York.
So how long has critical resistance been in existence?
We started up out in Oakland, California as a conference. Nobody had any intentions of creating an organization. It kind of came from that, and that was the conference was September 98, and then we had a follow-up Northeast Regional Conference in New York in March 2001, almost exactly a year ago.
Well, Bush's tax cut probably isn't going to help. Everything.
No. I mean, post 9/11, we, you know, struggle like a lot of nonprofits with money.
There's various notions of safety. Mm-hmm. Prison industry has been designed on one notion of safety. So could you describe your group's kind of critique of that notion of safety versus the other notions of safety at stake?
Sure. I mean, our mission statement actually says it pretty blandly, which is that there's this idea that public safety is somehow being protected by prisons and policing and surveillance, and that really what safety is something that can be defined from all kinds of different angles, and that if we define safety more broadly, as critical resistance does, it really doesn't only mean, it does mean physical safety, absolutely, you know, but it doesn't only mean physical safety, and it doesn't only mean, you know, safety to not get your stuff stolen. It means, like, the things I was talking about earlier, like, the safety to know that you can get healthcare, you know, the safety that, that you get by having a home, the safety that you get by having a, you know, a meaningful job, the safety that you get by knowing that you're going to eat, you know, and knowing that your kids are going to be cared for. And these are all these levels of safety that are equally important, but really over time, and I think probably in my lifetime, and I'm 27, our notion of safety has been completely shaped by this idea that, you know, the police protect your safety, or prisons protect your safety, or security cameras protect your safety. And we're totally sheltered to this, to any other notion of what it really means to be safe. And I think if you stop and you ask people what makes them feel safest, I did this recently for a project, the vast majority of people said, I feel safest when I'm with my loved ones. They didn't say, I feel safest when I see a cop car, or I feel safest when I know that so-and-so is locked up, or I feel safest under a security camera. They were like, I feel safest at home with the people I love. You know, and I think that we need to be thinking about safety in those terms, because without that, we can't address what's actually going to make people safe. And I think people forget that the people who are locked up are people, and their communities locked up inside prisons, and the safety of those communities is equally as important as the safety of people outside the prisons, you know, and we have to recognize that it's not something that some people get a right to and other people don't, you know, that it has to be defined much more broadly than that.
Awesome.
Thank you.